Okay, cool, fantastic, sexual, big, large, Devin. We did it. We did an improv game where we had to say the first sound that came to our head, and then the second person would say the first sound that came to their head, and then everybody together, while tapping to a beat constantly, would say those two things to the beat.
Oh, yeah. I know that game.
So we were just doing like, boop, bop, shpeet, bomp. And then I was like, Kevin, Devin, Derek. I had three boy names in a row, and it was, dude, it killed.
The Babylon Project was our last, best hope for peace. A self-contained world 5 miles long, located in neutral territory. A place of commerce and diplomacy for 250,000 humans and aliens. A shining beacon in space, all alone in the night. It was the dawn of the third age of mankind, the year the Great War came upon us all. This is the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2259. The name of the place is Babylon 5.
Hello and welcome to Chats, a television podcast, Season 6, Chatsalon 5. My name is Alan, and all life is transitory, a dream. We all come together in the same place in the end of time. If I don't see you again here, I'll see you in a little while in the place where no shadows fall. When I see you again, can you call me Magellan?
Yeah, well, that's my name.
Okay, so can we just play each other then for the rest of the podcast? I really want to do this.
Yeah, you are fascinated by this idea.
I've now brought it up twice to Magellan. Like, what if we did a whole podcast where we could play each other? Maybe I just want to eat you.
First time he asked me that, I was like, I just don't have the energy for it tonight.
Yeah. Alas, not tonight. That quote works a lot more better if I was like, Magellan, when I see you again, can you call me Baloney? But I was like, no, I want to mix and match and crypto crap and all that stuff, you know?
Oh, yeah.
We keep it spicy and unique and special here on Chatsalon 5, the premier Babylon 5 podcast.
And just kind of nice.
Deeply intimate and friendly. I wanted to see how long we could hold that. This is a podcast where Magellan, my best friend, and I watch two episodes of Babylon 5 a week, and we encourage you to join us. This week, we watched Season 2, Episode 17, Knives, and Season 2, Episode 18, Confessions and Lamentations. Knives was written by Lawrence G. DiTillo, directed by Stephen L. Posey. It aired May 17th, 1995, and it takes place in August of 2259. Magellan, what happened in this episode?
In this episode, he sees visions, dreams, strange dreams. Gradually, John Sheridan understands he's become host to an alien life form. Meanwhile, a friend of Londo Malari reveals he's being singled out for treason and is seeking help to defeat the accusation. Alan, can we just not talk about the Sheridan plot at all in this episode?
Yeah, incredible to me.
Skip it.
Jettisoning out the airlock like a teddy bear.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me that that's considered the A plot, man.
I know, it's ridiculous. And that's like in the Amazon summary, they're like, what's the main thing from this episode? Mm-hmm. The Amazon summary said nothing about the Londo stuff.
Really?
Yeah, remember? It was just like Sheridan is beset by strange visions. Or something.
You're right. Oh, yuck. They really do bury the lead with those Amazon descriptions, don't they? Goodness. Yeah. Well,
those are bury horses, don't they?
And shoot them first.
Well.
In that order, they shoot and then bury horses, don't they? Is that
what? I got it wrong.
Whoops. Oh, okay. No, you got it right. It's now the new right.
Yeah.
Please read my New York Times article, The New Right. Don't do that. Sheridan's alien going home plotline is echoing things like E.T. and Mac and Me, where it's trying to be wholesome. It's trying to have this story about like
how trying to be scary first.
Yeah, it's trying to be deeply. But E.T. is also a little bit scary at first. It's like, why is there an alien here? Oh, he's just a friend.
You say he's just a friend, but you got what I need.
Yeah, initially it's like, oh man, Sheridan's going cray cray. And it starts with this really dumb part where he goes into the gray sector. I don't know if that's the down below or if it's a part of down below, but they call it gray sec, and I thought that was cool.
Mm-hmm.
And he finds this corpse that was reported dead, and he goes to like examine it, and it jumps up and touches his eye. And I think that's I don't like jump scares in general. I did jump a little bit at that. I don't think they're good.
You don't like them because they scare you or because you think they're corny?
Both. No, I like things that are corny. I think that they're a writing crutch for being like, things are scary.
Yeah, that's fair.
You don't have to make anything scary as long as you keep things quiet and then make them really loud for 1 second. Like, that's not how horror has to work. And he starts having these weird visions. He has blurred vision. He starts seeing things. And it's you're saying the classic trope of this type of show where the doctor is like, I'm ordering you some rest and relaxation. That's an order. You're going to go take a nap.
You're just stressed. You've got a tough job. And also, you know, something that I kind of resent is that TV shows never actually make it about someone being really stressed, you know?
Right? The twist is never that he's just stressed. Yeah.
What if it was? What if this dude's got a very hard job and he is stressed? And the episode is just about, like, self-care.
Well, I would hope that Franklin's plot becomes that, where somebody has to be like, dude, you need to chill. You're like breaking yourself in half. You're overworked. Like, he's kind of going there, but in a much darker way.
Yeah.
But I agree. This constant like dramatic tension that comes from the doctor, the medical professional, being like, we are on a ship in 2259 where like sci-fi nonsense happens and you touched a dead body. It couldn't possibly be something that I don't understand. I did all the tests. Thusly, it's stress.
Right.
Like, it paints doctors as these types of people who can only work within the boundaries of their practice and what they understand and do nothing else.
Well, he said it could be a new kind of virus that I can't see yet.
So he gives Sheridan this, like, Beyblade bracelet, like the bracelet to use to control Beyblades in, like, season 6. And Sheridan continues to have visions. He starts seeing visions of his, like, the ship his wife died on, the Icarus, in space. He's in CNC at one point, and he's like, put searches out right there. And the girl in the back is like, on where? In this whole space? And he's like, I'm going to bed. Ivanova is confused, and then he has more visions. He wakes up in the middle of the night and sees his parents, Bob and Martha Sheridan, and they're like, come, John. They like have their hands out for him. And basically, it's like feelings of nostalgia and his past and like returning to a life he used to live, because he's seeing, like we said, he's seeing his ex-wife and his family. Eventually, he just has another dream and then gets up in the middle of the night, jumps in a Zeta Wing ship, and goes out into the middle of space. And we get this very dumb scene where Garibaldi's like, "Wait, what? Sheridan, what?" And he goes out. He finds a portal in space. I love that the Babylon 5 universe is one where portals just exist geographically and you just have to find them. And you can just walk. They don't exist until you're approximately 6 inches from them, and then they super exist.
Yeah.
And the white monster thing that's in him like slurps its way out, and then he passes out, and Garibaldi, like the best bro in the world, is like, all right, boss, let's go. Come on. We gotta go home now. You're drunk. Let's do it. I'll make you some Banya Cauda and we can watch Daffy Duck together. Wait, when is Garibaldi's now from Brooklyn? I just decided.
Yeah, that's fine.
How you doing? I'm Michael. What's his middle name again? Antonino? No.
No, Alfredo.
I'm Michael Alfredo Garibaldi. How you doing? Johnny, you're drunk. You're always drunk, Johnny. Come on.
Shut up, Johnny.
Shut the fuck up, Johnny. Your cousin wouldn't inhabit an alien body in their stomach. That's nasty, Johnny. You know that. And then they go watch the Disney Channel and then Daffy Duck marathons together.
Yeah, and we're done now, right?
That's it.
We can never talk about this plot again.
Nah, it's so nothing.
The main plot, which thinks it's the B plot, but it's really the A plot.
It's really the only A plot of these two episodes.
Yeah. Yep. Is Londo has a friend who is coming to town. First of all, the episode starts with Londo and Veer singing Centauri opera to each other.
It's so good.
Perfect.
No. The episode starts, sorry to correct you, the episode starts with the reveal that Babylon 5 has a batting cage in it.
Oh, yeah.
Which furthers this question of, like, how big is Babylon 5?
Well, it's five miles long.
Yeah, but, like, how much, like, but how wide is it then?
Yeah, like, how much of that mileage is a just a big field to hit baseballs over? It's not even... You don't even do anything in that space.
Exactly. A batting cage could be like a couple feet long. You just need like the length of how far you'll hit a ball.
Now, other possibility.
Yeah.
Is that
virtual space?
Yeah, yeah. Or it's like a holographic
holodeck.
Yeah, I don't. Maybe they're just hitting, you know, light object baseballs that turn back into the holographic space.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but it makes more sense to me than putting a whole big baseball field on a ship. Like, I think anyone would look at that and be like, that is a very inefficient use of space.
Exactly. We're already on our fifth Babylon project. It's because the first four, they kept trying to put Wrigley Stadium.
It was only baseballs. Yeah, it only was... baseball stadiums. On
exactly. Those. And they're like, oh, whoops, we forgot a bathroom.
We forgot life support. There's no air in here. It's just grass. It's just turf.
It's all grass.
Boss, we finished up the dugout, but we forgot to put engines on the thing.
How many miles did you use? Yeah, it was like 4.5 miles for the dugout.
Yeah, we made a 10-mile baseball field, and there's no spaceship parts anywhere to be found.
Wait, we're suffocating right now? We forgot air? God, yeah. I guess I didn't consider it. It could totally just be a hollow baseball field, but it's only used in that first moment where Garibaldi and Sheridan are like, wow, I love baseball. I'm American, and I love baseball. And then later, when Sheridan's having dreams and Garibaldi's like, wow, you play baseball when you're angry? And he's like, it gets the steam off. And that's it. But yeah, Londo is singing opera with Veer, and it's adorable and very charming. He's choked from behind by somebody who says, how funny that you die with a song on your lips, Mr. Mallari. And I'm like, shut the hell up, that Babylon 5. Don't do this in your cold open. Please don't play me like this. And then he lets go, and it's like, Erza, my buddy, how are you doing? And it's his buddy Erza Jado from Centauri Prime, an old dueling pal of his. I like to think it's like that plot line in House of Cards where he has like another rich friend. I'm sorry, I think Kevin Spacey's a terrible person, but.
Yeah, the oil guy or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And then they like go to the college and like get drunk in the college that they went to. And it's like, you guys are a bunch of wasps, just wasping it up. Mm-hmm. So Urza's another wasp who hangs out with Londo. And they're like, you got to try my weird alcohol. It's so good. Mm-hmm. Basically, over drinks, Urza reveals that he has a hit placed on himself and his family.
That the government is about to say that they're traitors or something.
Yes, exactly. And he wants Londo to help.
It seems like he's starting to figure out the plot that was laid to overthrow the emperor, and he's going to reveal it or something.
Yeah.
So he's like, Londo, help me out. My family's about to get dishonored. People are saying you're a great dude, you know.
And Londo's your star like, is ascending.
Yeah. Londo's like, I'll help you. We're buds. You're like my best friend. Hey, Reza, is that his name?
Rifa?
Rifa, yep, Rifa. He calls Rifa and he's like, hey, Rifa, what's up? And Rifa's like, hey, Londo, just busy killing people over here and scheming. And Londo's like, cool. So my friend, can you do something for him? And Rifa's like, oh, he is a traitor, dude. He's a total traitor. So yeah, we're gonna get him killed pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Londo's like, no, I'm vouching for him. And it's cool in this scene to see Londo start to realize that he's totally being fucked over and like made into a pawn.
Exactly.
And that he never actually had any authority of his own. Because he's like, just don't do that to my friend. I'm telling you not to. And Rifa is not even, he's not budging. He's not giving Londo anything. He says, you know, I can't help you. If you want to associate yourself with this guy, that's your problem.
You're gonna, you and your family are then gonna be twice as doomed if you help this guy out.
Yeah.
Also worth mentioning, main plot stuff, that it is in the conversation with Erza that he learns that the last Centauri Emperor didn't die of suicide. So, you know, furthering the, like, multiple Centauri Emperors in a row now have been this plan that that Rifa is involving him in has probably been going on for more than one generation.
Yeah.
Which is pretty interesting. Because I believe, no, I was going to say something about his buddy, but that didn't happen in this scene. Mm-hmm. But anyways, Londo feels really bad. It's a bummer to see Londo, like, understanding the wider spectrum of what Centauri Prime thinks and who's actually working with him and who is not.
Right. It doesn't seem like Londo knows much about anything that's going on Centauri Prime, because he didn't know this thing about his friend's family. And then when he goes to talk to, what's his friend's name? Erza? Right?
Yeah, Erza.
When he goes to talk to Erza and he's like, no, I talked to Rifa, everything's going to be fine. They're in this, you know, snazzy Centauri party, and it feels like there's a record scratch in the room. And Urza's like, Rifa, what are you doing with that guy? That dude's awful. He's a villainous man. Londo's just in over his head.
Entirely.
He's picked all the wrong people to ally himself with.
Well, he's with the bad guys. Like, when he realizes that... Not only, well, this is jumping it to the next big scene with them, but not only is Rifa not going to help him, but Rifa is the reason that Erza is condemned, basically. He says, they're having dinner it's not clear if it's a Centauri, like, bar or if it's a party or something, but Erza and Londo, and also Veer is involved. Veer's in the back just, like, slowly sipping a beer, listening to, like, his own headphones, listening to the Shins. And they're talking about plans, and he's like, Londo, or Erza's like, Londo, you're awesome. You're doing great work, and I'm so happy you're going to help me. You're going to clear my name. And then Londo's like, don't worry about it, bud. I already took care of it. My buddy Lord Rifa is going to clear your name. And he's like, who? Whomst? You mean the guy that's the reason I'm here? That's not cool at all. You're working with him? You're ruined, Londo. You're working with the bad guys. Londo's like, no way. It's impossible. I can't be working with the bad guys. Erza pulls out a gigantic comical sword, stabs it into the table, and says, Londo, if you're going to work with the bad guys, then I have no reason to work with you. I challenge you to a duel to the death. Honestly, I've seen more duels to the death in sci-fi than I've seen in fantasy. I don't know what that says about, like, science fiction's obsession with, like, people still clinging to old, outdated methods of conflict management. I think that's what that is, though. And we jump ahead and we get this, like, cool setup where they're wearing cloaks and then they get their cloaks pulled off by other dudes. And Veer, before they start the duel, is like, Londo, don't fight him. You don't have to do this. This is so stupid. He's like, no, but I have to keep my honor. You know how this works, buddy. They begin the duel. It seems like Urza's winning at first. He cuts Londo on the arm. And then when we cut back later, Urza's going for a killing blow. Londo's on the floor, and he has this look in his eyes like he sees the moment. He becomes incredibly present and goes, yep, this is the part where I now kill my friend. Almost as if he's, like, accepting his incredibly unfortunate state. Stabs Urza in the stomach. Urza's killed. In his final words, basically tells Londo, I died as a sacrifice for my family, because now there's no longer, like, the conditions.
The code of honor works is if you're killed in a duel, you're the guy who kills you, like, adopts your whole family.
Right.
Yeah.
And it does. So they're now safe because they're with you now. Promise me you'll take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the saddest part, because Londo's like, yeah, dude, I promise you, for sure.
Yeah. The shot, it's such a good shot, where Londo's cradling him in his arms and talking to him, and out of focus over his shoulder, you can see Veer watching. It's a genius shot. Because to me, Veer's arc in this episode is just as important as Londo's.
Yeah.
The moment where Londo's like, oh, I'll help my friend, Veer says, you know, for the first time, like, I'm proud to be your attaché. You're doing the right thing. And Londo's like, get out of here. Go away. And then Londo kills his buddy Urza. Mm-hmm. Then in the end, he's like, you know what, Veer? I'm starting to think I've made some bad choices.
I might be extremely owned, Veer. That might be entirely my fault. Thoughts?
Yeah, and Veer's like, well, that's okay. He's so hopeful.
Yeah.
There's still a chance for you to make some good choices. Yeah. And Londo says, no, the blood's already on my hands.
I might as well just keep being the villain of my own story.
Yeah. Oh, it's so sad for Veer.
That's the phrase. I use that phrasing intentionally, though. Londo is his own antagonist right now. Because every time he's provided an opportunity to get out, he's the one that either accepts the way things are or refuses to act to change them, like on principle or something. It's very sad, and he ends the episode saying, like, I will follow this path to the end and sleep if I can. And then we fade out on that. And it's like, oh, Lonto, you're not sleeping tonight, bud. You know that.
Yeah. Woof.
Indeed, woof. I have some minor stray notes on this episode, if you're into that.
Go for it.
If you're personally
I'm personally into it.
Veer, early in the episode, asks, like, who the hell is this Urza guy? And he seems suspicious, and Londo's like, Veer, you have such a negative personality. And Veer's like, no, I don't. And he's like, yeah, see? Nailed it. Wow. I'm right. We are all Veer in that scene. One of the visions that Sheridan has that we didn't talk about is super dumb. He's having visions, and he, like, wakes up to maybe the worst CG pterodactyl I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, yeah. Do you remember this shot? That was dumb.
He shoots it with his PPG. He breaks a window because it's not real. And then this cool security lady comes in with Garibaldi. And he's like, that was a Grylor. I saw it on Jano 7. Garibaldi's like, wow, really, really? It looks nice in the room, this gun hole in the window.
Oh, yeah.
It's very silly. I love Garibaldi's ability to find good in anything, in any situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't like the Franklin stuff being like, you might have either I don't know what's going on or you're just sleepy. Guess you should figure it out.
Yeah, I just don't like that the plot is belittling the impact that stress and overworking can have on someone.
Exactly.
It feels like.
A surprising amount of this show is about the harms of overworking yourself.
Yeah.
To the point where I'm like, oh, JMS didn't sleep when writing a lot of Babylon 5.
Right.
I'm remembering this now. It all makes a sort of sixth sense. There's a couple good lines here. Londo, before Urza puts down the dueling sword, says, I have a destiny to fulfill, one that would take our people back to a golden age, which is beautiful and also wrongheaded. Veer begs Londo not to tell Urza and says, insanity is part of the times. You must learn to embrace the madness. Let it fire you. Which is, again, wrongheaded. Like, Londo keeps saying these cool things that it's like, no, that's not... I can't, like, incorporate that into my life because that's wrong. I don't think that's a correct thing to think.
Yeah.
This feeling of like, well, we're all messed up anyway. I'm just the most messed up. Turns him into the Joker.
Right.
I'm just riding on it, baby. And then finally, when Sheridan is talking about how he might be possessed by an alien, they're like, I don't think you're insane. He's like, I prefer to be only slightly insane. And then Garibaldi's like, don't we all? This is just such a dumb...
That end scene is just dumb.
Exactly.
Ivanova is like, how'd you know there was an alien inside you? Like, come on, you guys.
What?
The only thing that would have made that scene dumber is if they were all at dinner with Warren Keffer.
Well, you mean dumber as in better. I agree with you, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Dumber.
Just trying to transition us to talking about the next episode.
The best character in the show. We'll talk about Warren Keffer in a sec.
Overall, you know, the Londo plot's fun if you like sad Londo, whose life is being ruined.
I do like sad Londo.
Yeah.
Also,
I also like that with other good stuff going on in the same episode.
Yeah. Is this show overall depressing, Magellan?
You know,
is it more depressing than not?
Well, it's season two, and I think that we've like heard or read that the plan was always for there to be 5 seasons, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're bringing us down into the depths. It's not going to feel good in season two. I think it's probably going to feel bad until like midway through season 4.
at the earliest.
And then it'll be hopeful. And yeah, then it'll sad.
I think it'll take a hopeful turn at some point.
It just feels like, especially in that second episode, we're just like parading around in misery.
Well, yeah.
Which I'm fine with. I'm honestly fine with. I don't want to say this like, when does the show get happy again? We're adults. I can handle sad television, but I'm just like, I'm coming out of so many episodes of Babylon 5 being like, well, shit. It do be like that sometimes. Man, the continuous theme of this is why we can't have nice things, perfectly illustrated in Confessions and Lamentations, which we will discuss after this brief musical break.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back to Chatsalon 5. The second episode we watched this week was Season 2, Episode 18, Confessions and Lamentations. It was written by Joseph Michael Straczynski.
I was so happy to get you with that.
directed.
Sorry. Once every like X number of episodes, I won't tell you what X equals. I'm just going to change it to Joseph Michael Straczynski, and you're going to have to just read it.
Yeah, I'll laugh every time.
Exactly. Thank you.
Directed by Kevin G. Kremen, it aired May 24th, 1995, and takes place in November of 2259. Alan, what happened in Confessions and Lamentations?
Well, Magellan, this is one of those episodes where I wrote and prepared a longer summary that kind of goes through all the beats. I don't need to read that because I don't think it's that important that we break down everything that happened in the episode. Instead, I will use what we usually use, which is the Babylon 5 wiki's much shorter, much more theatrical summary.
Okay, good.
And I'm going to put some thick reverb on this. You already know, listeners. The disease, Drapa. The mortality rate, 100%. While many aboard Babylon 5 turn members of the Thread Markov race into scapegoats, Delenn and Lanier risk their well-being to support them, and Dr. Franklin desperately seeks a cure.
That makes this episode sound way more action-packed than it is.
It's a misery play, man.
Yeah, it's sad, and it's messy, and it's just bleak.
Babylon 5. It's sad and it's messy and it's just bleak. This is the Warren Kaffer episode that we've all been waiting for, folks. I'm so happy to be here.
Get it out of the way.
Warren Kaffer is in a fun white sweater this episode. He is finding some signals out in the space. And he's worrying about something that he tells Sheridan about and tells Ivanova about. They think that it might be a mishap, so they send a squadron to find him. He's like, guys, there's a thing out there. And then Ivanova yells at him and says, no, you stop making problems, Kaffer. And he's like, okay, mom. Kaffer goes to his quarters. They find out that there's a ship out there. They bring it in for honestly, pretty foolish reasons. Being like, well, we got to help them. So we need to just bring them on the ship to help them instead of sending a medical team to them. And this way we just infect everyone on our ship. Mm-hmm. Although I guess an important thing to remember about Babylon 5, now I'm just thinking about the like more the mechanics of this episode, is it's only been around for 3 years. This is probably the first time they've seen something like this. They don't need to necessarily have like a plan in place for when they see a ship that's like, do we let them on? What if they have a disease? Because they don't know. Maybe they haven't seen that. At least like a ship as big as this one, because it has like a ton of like hundreds, thousands of people or whatever on it.
Right.
It turns out it's a ship full of people of the Markov race, and a bunch of them are really sick and dying, and they're like, why are you guys dying? Eventually, we find out from a doctor who is introduced in the episode as if he's always been like Dr. Franklin's best friend. Mm-hmm. His name is Dr. Lazarin, and he went to school with
Franklin. I think
he's
alluded to in the first episode.
Is he?
I think so. Franklin says something about, like, I have a Markab doctor friend or something.
All my friends are Markabs.
Yeah, he didn't know what was wrong with Sheridan, so he was like, I got this one friend who knows stuff.
Oh, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, offhandedly, we'd heard about him, I think.
Which is funny because chronology wise, these are. No, that's right. Yeah, Knives was August. This is November. That works.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Dr. Lazarin tells him, yeah, we have this thing in the Markab called the Plague and, or no, it's not called the Plague. It's called Drapha. And at one point, some family contracted it from God knows what. And they didn't tell anyone because they figured in our society that that means that they're bad and they're immoral and they have a failing in their moral compass that needs to be corrected.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't tell anyone about that because we'll be shunned from society. So they just kind of lived with it, and they all died of it. And then they also spread it to everyone else who also didn't tell anyone.
Yeah, and like I was ordered not to say anything or something.
Yeah, I'm only telling you because it's now on your ship. And he's like, "What?" This is a good example of like this seems like such an overdramatic thing, but it's not handled like an action episode. Franklin asks him like, "What is the mortality rate? And is it contagious? Like, how contagious is it?" And he's like, "It is 100% fatal and 100% contagious." Cut to commercials after this, like, this big twist. Like, oh, crap, we're all dead already. But really, if it was 100% contagious, we literally would have been dead. And this whole
Such
episode would mean nothing.
Line, dude. It was in, like, the most dramatic musical, like, bam!
Yeah, exactly.
Ugh.
It doesn't really go anywhere. They worry a lot. There ends up being a guy who asserts himself as the leader of the Markov, and he's like, yeah, I'm not gonna let you guys put my people in quarantine. And there's this pretty interesting moral question. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a cool roundtable discussion among the command team of what do we put them in quarantine. And Franklin's like, well, if it's airborne, that doesn't do anything because the air is recycled in the station. And if it's only affecting them and not anybody else, then we're just putting them all in a place to all get sick at once together and kill them all. Mm-hmm. And Garibaldi's like, yeah, but if we quarantine them, then we can protect them from people who are racist towards them.
Which does happen.
Right.
There's a scene where
that was
like
a cool discussion.
Yeah, and the smart thing that Babylon 5 does is when somebody says something like, oh, but if we don't do this, then this will happen, they always, like, show it happening.
Yeah.
Because they want, like, the ship is small scale enough that, like, things can happen and change in with the span of 45 minutes of an episode. So he says, like, what if violence happens on them? And then a couple minutes later, he watches a guy get kicked in the face by three humans who are like, he's bringing a virus on here. He's garbage.
Yeah. I really appreciate it when television shows or movies, I guess, show there being conflict between multiple people who are all trying to do the right thing
mm-hmm.
on some basic level, and they just disagree about how they're weighing different possibilities.
Right.
Because like Franklin and Garibaldi both want to protect these people and save as many of them as possible. Mm-hmm. They just have different methods.
Yeah, that is the best stuff in any dramatic television show. It's when everybody has a good reason for what they're doing. That's like perfect. Yeah. You have a good cast of characters if everyone has motivations that are conflicting in interesting ways.
Yeah.
There's a really weird scene that it's setting up the Delenn and Lanier stuff, but around here, a child of the Markov race like walks around the ship and he's like, Dad, 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 wake up. And then his dad is dead. And he just turns to his right and Delenn's like right there and he hugs her and she's like, it's okay, Johnny. And it's like, he doesn't know who you are. Why are you here? What's going on? You're just a friendly adult. Like, I get it, but it's just strange. That sets up this middle and late episode plotline where Delenn and Lanier opt to console the people of the Markov race that are quarantined in a corner of the ship. Because nobody else will, basically. And they're like, we are willing to take it upon ourselves to be empathetic and to listen to them and help them in their dying moments. And if we contract the disease, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Sheridan, I'll see you where the shadows can't reach or some stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah, where no shadows fall. Something, morality, self-sacrifice. That basically gets us to this really strong final scene. And I'm going to come back to, like, the Franklin stuff, but Delenn and Lanier are doing this. She runs into a girl in the quarantine zone who is has like separated from her mom, And she tells her, it's okay. I was lost from my parents for like weeks. I just hung out in a church and I fell asleep and that was fine. 2 seconds later, the girl finds her mom and she's like, oh, that works too. It doesn't really seem like we're learning anything about Delenn here other than she cares a lot.
Yeah, I don't know that we need to. It seems more like the point of what Delenn does is to show Sheridan that he's being inconsiderate, maybe. Mm.
Her and Lanier also have this this thing that they, this little like phrase that they keep saying, faith manages.
Yeah.
Like if you stay faithful, things are gonna work out. And they keep saying faith manages. She'll find her mom because faith manages. Which then loops around because they get like when Sheridan and Garibaldi and company come inside the quarantine zone after realizing that it won't spread to other races except the one other person that they brought on. They're like, hey, everyone here looks dead. Are they all dead? Like all of them?
Yeah.
Dylan's like, yeah, literally all of them, including that kid. And in fact, definitely including that kid and her mom and everybody. And this sucks.
I think the one thing that this episode gives us about Delenn, maybe it's not that she's being changed, but I think it's valuable for it to show us that she keeps her faith in the face of such tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
That she says faith will manage, and then she's devastated by this death, but then at the end of the episode she's still sticking by what she believes, you know. She's not disillusioned by it or made cynical by it.
Right. It's the power of faith. And the show is not looking down on her and like looking up on Dr. Franklin, a man of science. If anything, it's criticizing his methods. Like,
Or it's not, you know, it's sort of, he's the perhaps a foil to Delenn in that he is made cynical at the end of the episode.
Right.
He's deeply like, oh, just, there's no, you can't save people.
Mm-hmm. Nothing changes.
Yeah.
Because we really
learned that news report that's like, hey,
this
whole planet died.
I think a lot about the news reports on Babylon 5 because it's like the closest thing do we have to just like, oh, we have that, you know? We also have news reports where they talk about millions of people dying. But in our world, we don't hear about an entire planet's population, an entire race.
Yeah, 2 billion.
2 billion and change, and she was like, most of the people of the Markab that were on other planets are dead. Literally, the only ones who could make it were the ones who are living isolated in the middle of nowhere. And there's not enough of them to even consider them a race anymore.
Yeah.
The Markab are gone. Which is freaking heavy. Franklin is drinking at a bar appropriately, and the bartender is like, you know what? What do you call a bunch of dead Markab, like 2 billion dead Markab on a planet. I don't even remember what the punchline is, but it's stupid.
It was like planetary cleaning or something.
Like, yeah, like
that wasn't funny. That wasn't a joke.
And I was glad that didn't turn into Franklin like moralizing him or punching him in the face or anything like that.
Yeah, I was so worried he'd like hit him with his glass or something.
Yeah, but he already had his like emotional release moment where he throws all his medical equipment. So he instead just gets up, he says nothing changes, and he walks out.
Yeah.
And that's just a bleak, bleak way to end this episode.
Yeah,
just...
we're heading towards a real bad meltdown for Franklin, I think.
Yeah. To roll back a little bit, because I feel like we kind of accelerated through the plague plotline appropriately.
Oh, we're saving the best plotline for last, I feel like.
Of course, man. Of course.
Yeah. The love theme from Babylon 5.
Ugh. My brain is completely reset. Yeah, to wrap up all like the plague doctor stuff. There's like a guy who is part of the Markab who's like, I decided that we're gonna get quarantined because you can't talk to us. And it felt like they were gonna do echoes of that episode where there was the kid with the terminal illness that Franklin could have cured, but the family was too religious.
Yeah.
And I thought it was gonna be like,
faith. Their kid. Oh my god, I forgot.
Yeah, this show's amazing. You can't tell me the show isn't extremely good.
It's extremely good.
But I was worried they were going to do another thing where it's like, yeah, see what faith does to you? You guys all died because you were too faithful. Dummies.
Yeah. Well, you can read that in yourself. Like they did, the plague did accelerate beyond the point where it could be cured because of
them quarantining themselves.
Yeah. Because of them not talking about the fact that they had this disease.
Or yes, that's true.
Because even though it's a huge plague, Franklin does figure it out.
You know? Yeah, it's yellow cells, baby.
Yeah, like it could have been cured if they had treated it as a scientific thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Honestly, man, I think the Dr. Lazarin and Franklin stuff was my favorite relationship in this episode.
Oh, I disagree, but it was pretty good.
That's, yeah. Just the scenes where Lazarin very quickly, like Urza from the last episode, is like, I'm taking the moral way out. I'm going out honorably by making the decision to die for my people. And if you can find a cure by having me go in there and do the autopsy, then it's worth it. Yeah. And he goes in there and you just know he's going to die. You're not like hoping he doesn't. But as the disease continues to wear away at him, he's talking to Franklin. They're having memories. They're lamenting how things have gone. And it's just very sad and very, it's nice to know that like Franklin has had friends in the past. And something about the way that they're introducing the Franklin Stims abuse plotline is really like extra heartbreaking to me. And I don't personally, actually, I know some people who have had like really serious problems with drug abuse in the past, but like I personally don't, I have never used any drugs. And like, there's something about drug abuse plotlines, especially when it's a doctor who's using stuff, that just kills me.
Yeah.
Like he just jams himself. And then the doctor from across the glass is like, you know, that's not good for you. And he's like,
you must have loved House, huh? House MD?
House could. Dude, well, the thing is, I hated Dr. House. That's the point, though. It's not like I like him.
Really?
What do you mean, really? That's the point of the show.
No, you're supposed to love him. You're supposed to hate that you love him.
I guess I was too young to get that complexity. But I was just like, he seems like a garbage man. And if he wasn't, then it would actually be lupus for once. Was it ever? It was actually lupus once,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, once it was, yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, he's like, if I don't do this, then everyone else dies. And he can keep using that excuse. I want to like go into the TV screen and pull Dr. Franklin out and say, it doesn't work like that. You are not the only person who's qualified to do this. I know you feel like you are, and you're also justifying your already shitty behavior, but you're killing yourself. And in the long term, you're ruining the like medical wing of Babylon 5.
Yeah, we should keep track of this theme of self-sacrifice that you kind of alluded to in the first episode when we were talking about Urza and Londo. I forgot his name.
Lazarin? Londo. Yeah, Londo Mollari, Dr. Londo.
Sometimes students at school will be like, hey, Mr. And they like forget my name and I'm like, Fluke? They're like, oh, yeah.
Do you want me to cut out you saying your last name?
No.
Okay.
No. It's on our page, isn't it?
Oh, you're right. It totally is.
Yeah, dude.
Okay.
I'm not James Bond or something. It's fine. we were saying with Urza and Londo that it seemed like the first episode gives some glory to the person who sacrifices themselves or who puts a larger cause ahead of their self-interest. And that Londo is sort of, he was made to look kind of pathetic in a way because he takes this opportunistic moment to save his own life, even though he lost the duel, for all intents and purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And in this episode, Delenn and Lanier are made out to again seem sort of holy and honorable because they put their lives on the line. But Franklin is also, you know, he's performing a kind of self-sacrifice, but it's shown to us as being unhealthy. And so I think we should keep track of that. Is that a motif? Is that a theme? What is that?
Is that a light motif? Is that a musical recurring?
I don't know the difference.
Teach us. I was going to say someone teach us. We also have the whole internet.
I once had a conversation with two English teachers and a physics teacher about what the difference between theme and motif was, and we didn't come to an answer.
Really? I was going to say, don't you work in the same room as an English teacher? Or no?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Okay. Rock and roll. Anyways, yeah, we'll keep a pin in that because it's gonna continue to make me the sad. But this idea, like, I think Franklin's self-sacrifice is not seen as a good thing because it's a little self-inflicted. It's this feeling of like, I want to have the narrative that I'm helping people at the cost of myself.
Yeah, it's sort of, I get what you're saying.
He's not being presented with an ultimatum and choosing instead. He's making an ultimatum for himself.
I see what you're saying. Sure. Yeah.
That's how I feel.
I buy that. Yeah.
Yeah, this is just a sad season of television, man.
Oh, big time. But there is a bright spot.
Yeah.
Which is the sort of John Hughes movie that they're making out of Delenn and Sheridan's love for one another. Early in the episode, we have this dinner that Lanier, he didn't sleep for 2 days to make this very special dinner. Because if you make a single mistake while you're cooking, then you have to start the whole process over. And it's Delenn and Lanier and John Sheridan hanging out. John keeps wanting to go and eat a bite, but oh, wait, we got to pray. Oh, wait, we got to, you know, give food to each other. Oh, now we got to meditate. And he's like, ah, man, all right, well, I can eat in a second. And then he falls asleep. And they're like, you're making such an odd noise. I don't snore.
I don't snore.
Leave me alone.
Dad.
And then this delightful little moment happens where John's like, oh, got to go deal with the plot, the theoretical A plot over there. And Delenn's like, okay, well, we'll do this again sometime. Lanier looks at her with just, you know, poison in his gaze. You're going to make me cook for 2 days straight again. Because he would do anything for Delenn,
of course.
Yeah,
but I won't do that, you know.
And then she shrugs like, yeah, you know, but I like him. She doesn't say that, but they say that in Minbari.
Yeah, it's cute. It's a really cute moment. This is why when I'm, because I think it was the first half where I was like, is this show ever gonna like have happy moments? I'm like, these are the moments that I like.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, even amongst tragedy, because this is the same Delenn and Lanier who not 10 minutes later are like comforting a dying race.
Right.
So yeah. The show can have its swings and work with them in both ways.
Yeah, that's what made the Delenn having cutesy eyes for Sheridan plot cool for me this episode, is because it wasn't like previous episodes that did that, where it did that at the expense of Delenn being a wise religious lady. Mm-hmm. It had both going on. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, my favorite scene of the episode is when Delenn's like, hey, Sheridan, I heard you quarantine those people. And he's like, you can't leave the ship. And she says, I don't want to. I want to go in there with all the sick people and try to take care of them. He gets mad and he's like, no, I'm not going to let you do it. And she says, I have to do it. So I'm going to do it. And then things get tender and we get some really close shots on their faces.
Thick zoom,
teary eyes. And she's like, and hey, if I die, you know, we can still make out in heaven. She touches his face and he's like, oh, buh.
Buh, buh, real life.
And then he says to Lynn, when we see each other again, call me John. No, it was good. And she bites her lip and runs away.
So you're saying when she goes into the quarantine mode, does she go sicko mode? That's a very, very popular song called Sicko Mode by Travis Scott featuring Drake. Sun is down, sure, freezing sure. cold. My dog will probably do it for the blue. Well, I'll play like 5 seconds of it and we won't get copyright stricken at all. It'll be great.
Okay, great. But I really liked it, and I'm bought into Delenn Sheridan now. I don't know if I was not bought in before, but I'm ready for it. I'm bought
in. He's trying. I appreciate him trying to get her.
Yeah, well, what I appreciate is that the reason that that moment happened is because the characters truly believed that she could die.
Yeah.
And that's what made it feel like, of course, we know Delenn's not going to die. But seeing the characters believe it to the extent that this sort of big change happens in their relationship is narratively good.
I think I felt something like that when in the first episode when they start the duel. And I was like, Lano doesn't die in this duel, but I feel tense.
Yeah, right.
Regardless.
Like something is going to happen.
Yeah.
Big. And then, you know, when Sheridan finds her, she falls into his arms and goes, John.
John.
And that's a little much.
Uh-huh.
But I guess it's okay. I like it still.
It's okay.
I just wanted them to. I wanted them to kiss. But it'll happen.
They will eventually. You know you'll get it.
Yeah, I know. They got me though with these tropes. They got me
for sure. You're on one, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it seems like you don't care so much, huh?
I care so much in the sense that I hope it continues to be getting better.
Yeah.
That's mostly it.
All right.
I don't think it's bad or good right now. I just kind of am okay with it.
All right. I want you to have a strong opinion.
I have strong opinions about a lot of things, Magellan.
Yeah?
Yes, dude. You know
that. Do you have strong opinions about any other stray notes?
He says as he is clearly vamping, finding his stray notes. No. Oh, I like the part where Franklin is telling Dr. Lazarin about the real life Black Death. I like that kind of moralizing more than I like the end where Delenn is like, Sheridan, this is why people need to be nice to those who are sick and dying and left out in the cold. Be nice to homeless people. And it's like, okay, I'm sorry. Jeez. Wow, I'm sorry, Delenn. Like, the camera's, like, zooming in on her, like, this is a PSA. This is a PSA. Also, I just keep having this running thought in my mind that every time we see a character who is either overworked or questioning their faith or, like, working at the cost of themselves, yeah. That's just JMS and company, like,
yeah.
Just on the page.
Self-inserting, yeah.
100%, yeah.
Yeah.
I am also passionate about knowing what we are watching next week on Chats Along.
Well, let me tell you. Next week, we're watching two more episodes of Babylon 5 Season 2. The first is Season 2, Episode 19, Divided Loyalties. Lita Alexander, or Lita? Which one is it?
I think it was Lita.
Lita.
We'll find out.
All right. Lita Alexander returns to Babylon 5, convinced there is a traitor aboard. So Lita is the Psycorp person from the movie.
The telepath, yes.
The telepath. In the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Then, Season 2, Episode 20, The Long Twilight Struggle. A final bloody battle determines the outcome of the Narn-Centauri conflict
Woofa.
And signals an even greater threat to all civilization.
Woofa,
dope.
Woofa.
Dope. Dope.
So, next week's going to be big for a couple reasons. One, Lyta's coming back. I've heard she, like, is on the show. That's
cool.
Awesome.
That's cool.
Long Twilight Struggle. The Narn Centauri War is done in a season? That's amazing. How? Let's find out.
Yeah.
Also, worth noting, for people to get excited, both, not one, but both of these episodes our discussions are going to feature guests hosting with us. You too can guest on any episode of Chats on 5 or any Chats episode that you want that we haven't done yet by emailing us and letting us know at chatspod@gmail.com. Both of these listeners did that, and they are very welcome, and we're excited to have them on the show. So peep that. And again, email us there if you have any questions or comments. You can also just tweet at us at chatspod or get at us if you know our handles anywhere else. Rate us on that iTunes website application.
Do it.
You'll be cool. Do like 5 stars. It'll be so cool and spicy of you. Check out patreon.com/chatspot if you freaking love us. Because at $2 a month, you get a monthly commentary show called Commentary Chats, where John and I watch movies every month with you.
Yeah.
And you can listen to it with us. And at $5 a month, you get Chats Nights, where every 2 weeks we just talk. Our latest episode featured a recreation of the 90s Sears commercial, the I'll Call Now commercial. And also we did more conversation starters because we are creatures of comfort.
Ooh, yeah.
Peep that. John, what's your chatsum for this week?
My chatsum for this week, you know, I'm trying to track some habits and think about new habits I want to develop or change. And I think it's a good thing to do as long as you don't put too much pressure on yourself or obsess over it too much. And I've got one that, you know, it's been easier than I thought and made me feel better than I thought it would. That's to just try every day to eat one of your meals with no meat in it. Trying to have one vegetarian meal mm-hmm. every day if you can. And what you'll find is that there were some moments in your life where you're like, I feel bad today. I'm going to get a hamburger. And instead you're like, I feel bad, so I'm going to get the food that makes me feel good, like a salad. And that's nice.
But what if sometimes after a concert where I'm sad, I get a burger because I'm sad, and it feels good getting the burger.
Just as long as you had a salad for lunch, you're good.
What if I didn't have a salad for lunch because I didn't have time to make lunch?
That's all right. Just today you have double meat, and tomorrow you just get back on that train.
There we go. Ride the vegetarian train.
Partial. That flexitarian.
There
it's called.
Is it really?
Flexitarian. Yep. Sure is.
I like that.
And let me tell you, folks, if you're looking for a reason to go partial vegetarian, my reason, you know, it's not about animals. I care about them, but that's not the main motivating factor. The main motivating factor is reducing my carbon footprint, because the best thing that anybody can do to reduce their impact on climate change is to stop eating red meat. So,
wow. Is that true?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. I believe 14% of greenhouse gases are produced by animals that are being, what's the word? That are
slaughtered?
No, not that they're being killed. They're just producing that gas. The animals that we use for food, basically.
Methane? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Get a little bit of logic and science on you this week.
Yeah. And it makes you feel better, so... Those are both of my reasons.
We can always use that, for sure.
Yeah, what's your chat zone?
Well, Magellan, we are recording this on a Sunday, and on Saturday, yesterday, I was out with some friends for dinner, and we came back to another friend's house, and we had some board games. I brought over Risk, thinking that we were going to play Risk. The thing is, I'm not always in the mood for Risk. You have to kind of be in a very specific mood to play Risk.
Yeah.
And no one else seemed to be, and then we were like, oh, well, we have Monopoly right here. Mm-hmm. Let's just play Monopoly. So I'm going to have my chat some this week be the classic board game Monopoly.
Whoa, cool.
Stop me if you've heard this before. It's a game where you play a sort of send-up, a like comical loving send-up of the capitalist society and these like desperate land grabs. It's great. Honestly, Monopoly, like OG-ass Monopoly, no special rules, no house rules, just like follow that rule book and play the game, is like snappy and fun. Because what I've learned in the last couple of weeks is that the reason Monopoly like notoriously goes for too long is because you're hoarding money for too long. And if you play it with like the auction rules and all the spending and pass and go and getting the right amount of money, and you just play it normally, it's a fun game to just talk over with some pals, and like it's not too involved that you can't do anything else. Like, it's just a nice time.
Nice.
I like board games that integrate themselves into the evening as opposed to like becoming the evening. Do you know what I mean?
But you also like the ones that become the evening.
Yeah, there's room for both.
Yeah.
Because the ones that become the evening are like, I play D&D every week with some friends. I know what that is like. That's just your night. Or like, what's the Dominion?
Dominion. I love Dominion.
Dominion's very good. We should play more Dominion.
I got to get my Dominion set so I can bring it to school and get some nerds to play Dominion with me.
And create some nerds.
Yeah.
Go out there and create some nerds, folks. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Chat Salon 5. Peace.